She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World. We are disruptors for good. We are game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. Thank you so much for joining us and for being a part of our world. It means a great deal, trust me. And a very big thanks to one of our valued partners who has been with us since we started the Mrs. Green's World journey, the Chapman Automotive Group. They are truly committed to their employees, their community, and the planet. Their Community Green Team are true leaders in their work for a sustainable and socially just planet, and they have received national recognition for their contributions on so many levels. For more information about Chapman and all of the many fuel-efficient cars they sell, which makes Mrs. Green happy, you can visit ChapmanTucson.com. And again, Chapman, thank you for all you do. For this next hour, we're going to be talking about our children, protecting their rights and their lives, and how doing this fits into creating a sustainable and socially just planet. Joining us for this hour is Zema Neff, Executive Director, Children's Rights Division for Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch is a nonprofit, non-governmental human rights organization made up of roughly 400 staff members around the globe. Its staff consists of human rights professionals, including country experts, lawyers, journalists, and academics of diverse backgrounds and nationalities. Established in 1978, Human Rights Watch is known for its accurate fact-finding, something so important in these challenging times around facts, impartial reporting, effective use of media, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local human rights groups. Extremely impressive and well-respected work around the world. Trust me, I've done a lot of research. Zema, thank you so much for joining us. And not only that, for the important work you do every day on behalf of the world's children. It's really wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I gave a little bit of an overview on Human Rights Watch, but can you just add some more information on the magnitude and scope of what this organization is doing? It's almost challenging to get your head around when you start reading about it, partially because of all the hotspots around the world when it comes to human rights violations. And yes, you're part of providing credible, respected information, but that's just a piece of what your organization does. So tell us a little bit more about Human Rights Watch.
Well, Human Rights Watch is an organization dedicated to stopping human rights violations. And that goes just as much for children as it does for adults. We're an independent organization. We do not take any government money. We dedicate ourselves to producing unbiased, rigorous, hard-hitting fact-finding, then taking information and using it to do everything we can to stop human rights abuses from occurring. In fact, we use three words to sum up how we work, which is investigate, expose, and change.
So important. And I keep, you know, thinking about that word unbiased. Just elaborate on that a little bit more. It's what scientists do when they're reporting about climate change. They're not really trying to get a bias in here. They're measuring data and reporting it, and then they're accused or applauded for being, you know, climate reality advocates. So what's the unbiased part? You just report the facts as you find them?
We do. I mean, you could say that we are biased on behalf of the victim.
Right.
And the work is in part about letting victims speak out and ensuring that their rights are protected. But that means that we're going to talk to everyone who has information, whether it's people who are suffering human rights abuses, children who are forced to work long hours in dangerous conditions, or who are locked up sometimes for the rest of their lives, but also talk with people who are accused, whether it's children's employers, whether it's government officials, or whether it is international donors who are perhaps complicit or who have the power to do something differently. It's about getting as accurate information as possible and really presenting the information in a way that is not biased in any way.
So what a great answer. And in terms of moving on to children and their rights, give us a little bit of basic education about what are some of the major human rights that are being violated around the world every day. What are you focusing on in terms of Human Rights Watch?
Sure. I mean, you know, children, just like adults, have basic human rights. And while they're often, you know, seen just as objects of maybe seen as objects of pity or as victims, we find in our work that too often abuses of children are happening not because of some sort of inevitable situation, but because of decisions that are made by individuals, decisions to violate the rights of those children. And those are decisions that can be influenced in people who can be shamed and forced to act differently. So, in the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, we work on everything from trying to protect children in war, to protect them from being forced to fight as soldiers or for having their schools and teachers come under attack, to children who are working in very dangerous conditions that interfere with them getting an education. We work to protect migrant children who often flee war or terrible conditions in their homes, and instead of finding protection in Europe or the United States or elsewhere, find themselves locked up. And we work on the right to education, which is just a fundamental building block for the future of every child. And if a child is denied an education, it's very unlikely that they will be able to live a life free of poverty in the future.
And there are specific things about what you define as an attack. I mean, you have very clear things and you touch some of them, but there's a full range of violations that put these kids at risk and actually deny them to education. So just go a little bit deeper into the weeds, as I say, on what kind of attacks does this include?
Well, I'm glad we're going to talk today about protecting children in war, because this is both, I think, a terrible violation that we're seeing on the front pages of our newspaper, but actually, when you take a step back, an area where many countries are still making significant progress. So when it comes to protecting children in war, you see everything from children being targeted as civilians. We've got horrible news from Syria, where their children have been gassed, whether they've been bombed by government or other forces, and have simply just been casualties in the conflict. We also see children who are denied humanitarian assistance, as has been happening in eastern Ghouta in Syria. We see children who are victims of sexual violence. But we also see children who are forced to fight as soldiers when they're too young to fight. And we see children having their schools or their teachers actually not just be sort of casualties of conflict, but be intentionally targeted as a tactic of war. And those are two areas, protecting children from being forced to fight as soldiers and protecting schools in war, where Human Rights Watch has been working, where I think we're seeing some progress.
And does it spill over? I mean, are these attacks also on teachers and parents? And I know sometimes we're going to talk a little bit about gender, for maybe not a little bit, maybe a little bit more, but aren't they also targeted at times, the threats and the harassment for even wanting to educate kids?
Yes, and you know, this is something we've documented in almost every war around the world, but I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, take Malala Yousafzai. She's probably one of the best known targets. She was shot in the head and the neck for refusing to stop demanding girls' education in Pakistan. She was shot by the Taliban in Pakistan, who tried to kill her for fighting for girls' education. A lot of our listeners have probably heard about Afghanistan, where we found girls' schools are intentionally targeted by Taliban, by other militias who oppose girls' education. But we've also found boys' schools, for example, in Afghanistan targeted out of groups that simply see education as a symbol of Western influence or government. And in other places where, for example, in the Maoist complex in India, where schools may be the only symbol of government around, and they're targeted because they're a soft target. It's easier to attack a school and make a statement.
And
but the effect on children is terrible, yeah, including the effect on rebel groups who may be claimed to be fighting on behalf of their children after they destroy their school.
Right. And I had a guest on recently that actually talked about she doing work in Afghanistan, and she said that she was so hopeful and excited about, you know, several years ago about getting girls bicycles and how that really helped protect them from harm, and they're not walking, they're riding their bikes, and what a sense of freedom it was to those girls. And of course, sadly, of late, they have been the target of major attacks and threats and life-threatening, you know, to their family, and a lot of violence around girls riding bikes, which is kind of you can't get wrap your head around it in the United States, for as challenging as I think things are right now with children's rights. Even here, every girl that wants to ride a bike can ride a bike.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that makes such a deep impression on me are the teachers and the children I've interviewed in Afghanistan and elsewhere who are willing to risk everything in order to get an education. And, you know, as a parent of school-going children now, I think that's something that really is impressive, to see children and parents taking real risks. And I'm thinking of a teacher I met in rural Afghanistan outside of Kabul a number of years ago, who had started up a school right outside of her family's compound. And not long before I visited her, a grenade was left in that school. Some kids found it before school started, and fortunately, no one was hurt. But they moved the school into the courtyard of her family's home, so the kids were studying outside, and teachers, you know, had no enclosed classrooms, and she was still teaching, even though she had been threatened. And what she said to me was, she said, "I'm a soldier. I'm running the school, and I have housework and six children. It's a challenge for me, and I will never stop this school." And I think I have met teachers and students and parents who are putting their lives on the line in order to get an education, and we really owe it to them to do all that we can to make sure that they get that education.
And I just, it just begs the question. These are the things that keep me up nights. What's the deal? What are people so afraid of? When children are educated, everybody wins. Like in the United States, where education is so underfunded in most places, including my home state, 49th in our services, when children are educated, everybody wins, because they go on to be successful members of society, to sound a bit cliche, but it defies description to me. It's beyond my understanding how... What are people afraid of? Why? I'm not expecting you to have an answer to that, but since it is your area, what's the deal? What's your insight as to the fear of educating our children?
Well, I think it varies a lot from place to place, and that's why you know, finding the facts out on the ground is so important, because you have to know why schools are being attacked in order to protect them. So if, for example, you go to a place like Southern Thailand, where the rebel group there sees schools as an imposition of Thai Buddhist government culture, that it's something that's foreign.
Got it.
And schools and teachers have been directly attacked. We have unfortunately interviewed teachers who were later killed in their school when they were attacked by those rebel groups. But one of the things that now is being tried is to have language that reflects the language of the community, to do more to change the curriculum, to make schools less of a flashpoint. One of the other things that we found in our research, starting in India and then elsewhere, was one of the things that gets schools attacked is when militaries use schools for military purposes, which. You know, to many folks I talk with in the United States on a normal basis, sounds very, very unusual. But in a war situation, a military may come in and want to spend the night somewhere, and the school looks very attractive, and there's roof, and there's classrooms that look like barracks, and maybe there's a kitchen, maybe there's latrines, or maybe their post got attacked and they're looking around for some other place they can go, and the school looks good, so they move in. And we find that sometimes when we've seen this in Central African Republic, in Yemen, in Somalia, in India, southern Thailand, in almost every conflict, when troops move in, a couple of things happen. One is that even if the school tries to continue to function around them, it creates a terrible environment for education. I mean, a girl described this in Yemen, for example, when she was at recess and troops brought in a suspect and tortured him with electricity in the school compound during recess. Who can get an education in that environment? Parents are quick to pull, especially their girls, out of school.
Yeah.
The other thing that it can do is get the school attacked by the other side. One of the things that we have been campaigning on is to keep militaries out of school and keep schools safe, even in the midst of a conflict situation.
And just go with that a little bit more. When you advocate for that, what kind of pressure can you put on it? Is it the eyes of the international community? Is it the leadership in power saying this is a disgrace and we look bad to the rest of the world? Having the facts and having the information, what kind of pressure can you bring to bear on stopping it?
Well, this has been a really interesting effort, because when we started on a country-by-country basis, we found that when we presented to militaries or to governments the effect of having troops in the schools, people pretty easily recognize that it's a bad idea to put troops inside the school with the children. And after our reporting, the Thai military cleared its rangers out of about 300 schools in southern Thailand. The Department of Peacekeeping Operations prohibited UN peacekeepers from using schools, in part because they had seen for themselves in the Democratic Republic of Congo and elsewhere what it did to schools to have peacekeepers there. It's kind of an obviously good idea. But going country by country is fairly slow. And as we began to partner with other groups, for example, you know, wonderful humanitarian agencies like Save the Children and others, we found that this is a problem everywhere and needs something bigger. And governments have now taken this up in the form of it's a political commitment called the Safe Schools Declaration.
Which was my next question. It's great. Perfect segue. You're channeling me. But I'd love you to tell about that and the impact it's had or can potentially have on children's rights.
Yeah. So to date, in the last 3 years since we've been running, since this initiative has been up and running, 73 countries have signed this political document called the Safe Schools Declaration. And that's a promise not to attack schools in war, which was already illegal, but specifically to restrict military use of schools, to make it harder for their own militaries to use schools. And 73 countries is more than a third of countries in the world. It includes countries at war, countries at peace. It includes countries in every region of the world. And the numbers continue to grow. But you know, if I were a listener or a skeptical human rights worker, I would say, what good is a signature on a piece of paper? And the answer is, in the 3 years since this has been up and running, governments are also beginning to change their rules for their troops and make it off limits to use schools for military purposes. And that's happened, you know, there have been directives that have been sent directly to troops. There have been military manuals that have been changed. And, you know, most troops are trained to follow rules. And when the rule that they've been trained on says, don't use the school, go someplace else, that's much more likely to happen. It's a step-by-step process, but we've taken something that no one even recognized as a problem maybe 10 years ago. And now we're beginning to see countries realize that it's not good and that they should do something different and actually acting differently.
And it's one of those positive things that I promised you we'd talk about. I mean, it's measurable impact of change in the right direction. And yes, signing the declaration is symbolic, but it obviously has some teeth. So we are going to be taking our first break. And when we come back, I would love for Zaima to share with us about the Global Coalition to Protect Education from Attack. There's a lot going on there. And we're going to go into some of the other things that are having an impact in terms of children's rights. So much more good information to come. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back in 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and we are the disruptors for good. We are stirring it up, and I love it every time I say that. It inspires me. We need to be stirring it up and disrupting what is and work for what we want to see. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. With us this hour is Zaima Neff. She's the Executive Director, Children's Rights Division for Human Rights Watch. In addition to that, she also co-chairs the Global Coalition to Protect Education from Attack. She has conducted fact-finding investigation and is the author of reports and articles on a range of issues affecting children, including access to education, police violence, refugee protection, the worst forms of child labor, and discrimination against women and girls. She has published on op-ed pages in major international and U.S. publications and speaks regularly to the media. And I find this most interesting and so reflective of Zaima's passion and commitment to making a difference. During a sabbatical, which is supposed to be, I think, time off or to look at something different, she ran a protection monitoring team for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Sri Lanka. Before joining Human Rights Watch in 1999, Zaima clerked for U.S. federal judge, advocated on behalf of immigrants and refugees in the United States, and worked with community development and women's organizations in Honduras. So you have been preparing for this role for a very long time, Zaima, and thank you for what you do and for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What an impressive commitment to social justice and human rights. It goes without saying. So tell us about, you're part of a bigger, a greater whole, the Global Coalition to Protect Education from Attack. What is it? You know, when did it start? How does it work?
Sure. When we first started, I think back in, even in 2003, which was the early days of the Taliban being ousted from Afghanistan, and I was with a colleague in the Southeast documenting something different by abuses by local militias. And it was the first time that I started hearing stories about a grenade being left under a teacher's chair or a rocket being fired into a building. It was the first time that I had heard about school attacks, which sounds, you know, surprising now. But back in 2003, this was supposed to be the success story of Afghanistan. And one of the reasons why the United States and other countries got involved was to help women and girls get an education in Afghanistan. And as we looked around, we began to realize that this wasn't just a problem of Afghanistan, that attacks on schools was something that was happening as a tactic of war, that it instills, it terrifies people in the population. It hits people where they're really vulnerable. It's a particularly devastating way to scare people and to kill children. And the more we learned about it, the more we started thinking, what can we do? And at that time, we often work closely with wonderful humanitarian groups in the field. You mentioned that I had the privilege during a sabbatical to work with the Norwegian Refugee Council, which was a terrific organization. There are a lot of other groups that in conflict situations will go in sometimes instead of, sometimes it's side by side with the government, and keep trying to provide children with an education. Right? Often in low-level conflicts, there's still a way for kids to get an education, and time keeps ticking, and kids can't miss out and go into school. And what we found was that they had been dealing with these problems for years, and it was something that really characterizes conflict. And we thought, how can we join together using human rights lawyers and child protection specialists and people who, teachers who deliver education in emergencies to try to improve the situation for children in war? And so we started this coalition, which includes UN agencies like UNICEF, which is the UN Children's Fund, UNESCO, the cultural agencies, the UN refugee agencies, and also nonprofits like Human Rights Watch and humanitarian agencies, trying to work together for a common purpose. And I would say part of the inspiration for me was looking at what the world had done on stigmatizing and stopping the use of child soldiers. And you think, you take care of a problem of child soldiers is something that that 50 years ago was not even recognized as a problem in itself. And today it's still a problem, but the numbers of child soldiers are way down, and rebel groups and militaries know that they're going to face serious consequences if they use children to fight. And that's what we want to do with attacking schools and using them for military purposes. We want to make them as unacceptable and as stigmatized as using a child as a soldier.
And another thing that I admire and respect and I think is so powerful is that through this group, there's actually, for lack of a better word, a menu of actions, because part of it is like not staying in the what, but staying in the how to change it. And some people then flounder. But I thought it was really impressive that you actually have, here's what you can do. Here's a list mm-hmm. of things that you can do to protect children, to protect education from attack on schools and military use. I mean, a menu of actions, to me, things like that are so important for people that might have the will to change. And it's like, tell me where I start.
For me, it's been very exciting and illuminating as a human rights lawyer to have the chance to work with education specialists. And I think as a human rights lawyer, we can talk about there needs to be punishment for people who attack schools. Here's where we need to change the laws and to push for that to be done. While at the same time, our education partners are able to say, here are ways to strengthen school walls, infrastructure. Here's things that you can that can be inflammatory in curriculum. Here's training for teachers that makes students safer. And, by pooling that kind of expertise, it's been a way for us to tell countries, this isn't a problem that you have to accept. There are things that can be done. And here's a whole bunch of examples of other countries facing conflict that have done those things and had success.
And it's just, I mean, that's the part that gives me hope. And I looked at a lot of it, and it helps. It's like, yeah, you can do this, and you can sign this, and you can implement this. So solution is always the place that I like to end. And some days I got to admit it's harder than others. So I am sure you are aware of the impact of the Me Too movement in the United States. And it's been a very positive thing for women and for men who care and for our country. But without diminishing any of that and how horrible all of those experiences were for women, isn't the overall war on women a far bigger deal? And that's a very, slippery slope for me to go on, because I don't want to diminish any woman whose rights have ever been violated, especially sexually. But it's part of a bigger picture that we all have to kind of join hands and focus on and be agents for change. Would you agree or disagree, or how would you add to that?
Well, I think it's a good point. I don't think we need to make comparisons, but I think something very exciting is happening right now. And, from an international perspective, it's about, tomorrow's International Women's Day, as you're probably aware, March 8th, the ways that women are fighting for their rights, women and girls are fighting for their rights around the world. And that means protecting women from violence and ensuring that there's a punishment and accountability and punishment for people who use violence against women. It means working to stop the use of child marriage. It means ensuring that girls and women get an education. And I think one of the areas we've been really looking into at Human Rights Watch is girls' right to secondary education, to high school. And, you know, in this day and age, it's not enough to have a primary education. Whether you're in Afghanistan and you aspire to be a midwife or a teacher, or elsewhere in the world, if you're in Tanzania, for example, where the president has put out an order that pregnant girls be kicked out of school, having a secondary education for girls is critical. They face terrible barriers, and those are things we can do something about.
So is there more of a focus in general? You bring up higher education. Are universities also a target for the violence and the attacks?
They are. And one of the things that we've been reporting on is how universities themselves, which are often, you know, maybe more politicized than primary and secondary schools, are not under attack. But also, you know, they're even there, examples of hope. Where you look at, for example, African Union peacekeeping forces recently vacated the National University of Somalia, where they had been camping out for 10 years. We're beginning to make it really hard for troops to publicly and openly use schools and displace students, including universities.
So let's move on to the overall gender gap. And I read some information that was not very exciting to me or heartening to me. The World Economic Forum at the end of 2017 or the beginning of this year declared the global gender gap widening, and that it's worsened. Growing inequality in economic participation, a particular problem. And given that you're fully immersed in the rights of children and you have a finger on the pulse of the treatment of women in general, from your perspective, why is it worsening with all this information? And there is some good news. What's going on that it's actually worsening?
Well, to say for kids, the overall trend is good.
You know, yes,
our job
good.
As human rights
good.
Workers is our job as human rights workers is to point out where the problems are, and that's exactly what we should be doing. The things that children are experiencing around the world today, whether they're being, you know, bombed in Syria or kicked out of school because they're pregnant in Tanzania, are absolutely unacceptable. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that the gap between where we are and the ideal is not the same as saying there hasn't been any progress. There has been huge progress for kids. There are, you know, millions fewer children working in the most dangerous, worst forms of child labor. Overall, access to primary education has increased. But that in no way should give us a sense of complacency. It's a sense that we can actually... there's progress that's been made, and there's a lot more that needs to be done.
And even when you think about like Malala and the power of social media and what she's done, and I will tell you, even in Tucson, Arizona, with a high school that I work with called Changemaker, it's a charter school for really bright kids that traditional education just isn't a fit. They had a fashion show, and guess who their role model was for the fashion show? I mean, she permeates young girls' heads. She gets into their heads,
wow.
And she is held up as such a hero. I mean, you know, stronger than. She couldn't be taken out, beaten down, I mean, despite everything. So, yeah, so that inspires me.
And we're really inspired over here also by youth activists, including in the United States, and
yes.
Certainly in response to the shooting in Florida. But recent youth activism also predates that in all sorts of recent social movements. And I think, you know, the internet and social media is a very exciting platform for young people who are trying to make change.
We're definitely inspired. Yeah. When used right, it's the most powerful tool that they have at their fingertips, and it's working. And you're absolutely right. Who's not going to march on the 24th? You know what I mean? I know that everybody I know that wants to still be my friend is going to be out there with a sign. And I don't mean that for my friends that are not called to march. So a big surprise to me in my work with climate reality and climate change and global warming, which to me should be a part of everyone's focus, because if you're a human rights activist, who's getting hurt the most by climate change and climate reality? At-risk communities, marginalized communities, people living in poverty because they don't have a way out. So one of my favorite new passions is the best-selling book Drawdown. and it's the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And what they did was epic, and it is a scientific approach, and they came up with 80 solutions globally that provide not just ways to slow down global warming, but in fact draw carbon down from the atmosphere, which is what needs to happen. And they ranked it. So what surprised me is in the ranking, which was done by scientific measurement of the impact of CO2 emissions, number 6 highest was the education of women, and number 7 was family planning. So speak to this. Why is it so important that as a global community, we focus on and fight hard for the rights of women and girls, and everybody wins when that happens? The planet wins. It's like it's a win-win-win-win-win.
Well, I'm fascinated to hear about the connection with climate change, but I couldn't agree more that educating girls and women isn't just good for them, which is, you know, front and center of the world, but it's good for everyone. And, you know, there's good research on how it affects the health of their children, the health of communities, the ability of women to participate in the workforce, and it has much broader and important implications. You also mentioned family planning, and at Human Rights Watch, we have been working hard to ensure that that girls and boys have access to accurate, comprehensive, quality sex education and family planning, and also have access to reproductive health and family planning services without discrimination.
And it's funny, when people say to me, sometimes I get on a rant, sometimes I feel like I need to get down from the soapbox and hopefully don't sound like I am in judgment. People say, well, what's the answer? What's the answer, Gina? It's all gloom and doom. What's the answer? And I look them square in the eye and I say, educating girls. To me, that is the answer. It's like, if you start there and have this global population of girls who want to become women and protect their children and create, you know, opportunities for everyone, it's that mother instinct, and it's so out of balance. It's just innate in us. So, you know, that's my own personal bias, but when I read Drawdown, it's a book that I would recommend to you, Zaima. It's fascinating because it touches every part of the world of scientists coming together and not making up new solutions, but using the ones that are already working to impact climate change. It's just, I have it by the side of my bed. And if I get really down, I just read about, you know, cattle in the forest, because it's a book about hope and solutions. And some days I need that. I don't know if you want to foray into the United States, which in the past, to me, has been a champion of human rights, of protecting the rights of children, and to a large extent, it still is. Not always successful when it comes to funding for education, and I was in the mental health profession for 35 years, certainly not in prevention dollars for at-risk kids, but overall, I would say a fairly good track record. In terms of the global observation or opinions about the current administration, has that attitude changed, or is it, you know, where are we standing from the global view, which not a lot of us have? We read what the press feeds to us, unless we go on alternative media sites. So does this country still value and protect our children?
Well, I mean, the people I talk with in this country value children very deeply. I think that's something, it's hard to find a place where people don't value children. I think the question is, how are the values that we share, whether it's about children or other responsibility to our communities, how that gets translated in the actions of our government. There's no question that the United States has had incredible influence on protecting human rights over the years, and also incredible negative consequences. I mean, this is a moment where, not just in the United States, but in Europe and elsewhere, we are seeing the rise of individuals and governments that are very hostile to human rights, and it creates the moment where now more than ever, it's important for us reassert what our values are, and when that includes protecting children's right to live and right to health and right to get an education without discrimination, those values are more important than ever. I think two areas in the United States, one of which has me very worried, and the other of which gives me a source of hope. And the first has to do with the rights of child farm workers in the United States, where, you know, I've been in the fields and in states around the country where children are working very long hours in dangerous conditions at very poor pay, often endangering their education. And most of those kids are Latino. And one of the reasons that they're working such long hours in such dangerous conditions is because of a loophole in the U.S. child labor law that leaves children who work in agriculture with far less protections, far fewer protections than any other working children. So kids can be hired, so we're talking about hired labor, kids can be hired to do things on farms that would be completely illegal in any other context, whether it's a Walmart or an office or a fast food restaurant. And we've been painting, working with others in the United States for years, trying to get that loophole closed and try to give child farm workers who are mostly Latino the same protections as all other working children in the United States. That has me very discouraged that Congress has not been willing to step up to do that. On the other hand, we've seen in the state of California, for example, real efforts to change the way the state accuses children who are accused of convicted of crimes. And in the last 10 years, we've seen the state change its laws to ensure that more children are treated as children, and that they're treated not just locked into dangerous adult prisons, and to also, for the most serious crimes, ensure that sentences are not so extreme that nobody ever goes back and takes another look. So I think there's some positive trends in the United States to point to as well.
And as you referred to, I mean, a really positive change for me are the possibility now exists that we will have gun control legislation in our country because of the kids. How articulate they are, how educated they are, how passionate they are. So to me, I see that as a very bright spot, because I've been writing and tweeting and saying, who's protecting our children? It gives me so much hope, and they're getting attention.
They are. And, you know, it's interesting because you hear a criticism that the children are being manipulated, that this is actually the actions of adults. Well, I have met child activists all around the world who have made a difference in how their countries are run. And I have great hope that today's young activists are gonna make a difference. But there should be, you know, no question that youth activists can really make a difference and not just be tools of adults. On the other hand, I think we as adults have a responsibility to respond to children who are demanding that their schools be safe, both in the United States and elsewhere.
It creates a bigger connection to a global community of people who care. One of the things that gives me hope too, like the whole genesis of Mrs. Green started in the Amazon, first in Peru, and I just recently spent a couple of weeks in Ecuador, deep in the jungle. I tell everybody, this was not a cruise. It was not a river cruise. It kicked my butt, and I learned and I grew, and my passion was definitely deepened. And there, again, Zaima, it's women who are leading the charge to protect the Amazon from the oil is the biggest impact now. It's not even deforestation for lumber. It's oil companies coming in and just destroying entire communities and cultures forever. But it's women and girls and the grandmothers marching and saying, no more, you're not going to take our earth back. So that's a hope. What about climate change and the refugee crisis? And I do have a question here, but what I know from my research and my interviewing of some of the greatest minds in the world on climate reality, I think in general there's a lack of connection between the impact of climate change and our current refugee situation, especially Syria. I've read so much about it. What happened is people lost their land. They were starving. It was destroyed. So we have a refugee crisis globally. It's unfathomable to me. So how do we get our head around educating children when they're living in refugee camps, or if they're lucky, they're living in refugee camps?
Well, I think you're right to say that only more and more we have to deal with how climate change displaces children and their families. And educating kids who have been displaced is, while nothing new, something that's going to be really, really important. There's a lot of expertise on how you educate children who come to another country. But I think what we really need to shore up at this moment is the priority, the value placed on protecting children who are fleeing from terrible circumstances. And no child should ever be locked up solely for the purposes of immigration control. Yet even in the United States, Human Rights Watch has just put out a new report describing how children and women apprehended at the border, and including in Arizona, have been routinely held for days at a time in freezing cold cells, basically forced to give away their outer clothing, given some Mylar blankets. We have, you know, footage of women trying to change babies' diapers in these freezing cold cells with no protective clothing, sleeping all the children huddled together and not allowed to shower or wash their hands. And so, you know, that is no way to treat children who are often traumatized and, you know, who need protection and need education. And the consequences for all of us are, you know, as you pointed out, you know, that the world benefits from educating children, and the consequences for leaving people uneducated are ones that are felt not just by the children themselves.
And so many times when I'm doing a show, people will talk about the beginning of their journey. I used to ask that question a lot, and they weave into the conversation the impact of their mother or their father or their grandparents and how that helped form their path. And my father, his favorite expression when I talk to him about painful things, like, why didn't we stop the Germans from burning the Jews, Daddy? I remember when I was little having that conversation with him. And he had an answer, and I accepted it and believed him. You know, we weren't always aware of what was happening because it wasn't social media and the beat goes on. But he used to say always, man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn. And you can imagine how many times that comes back to me in doing the shows I do and covering the topics I do. And, you know, I was thinking about and looking on the website in my you know, research about... One of my things is, you know, child labor, which you touched on, and women in factories. I told you that I did a show yesterday about Bangladesh, and women, 90% of the workforce, a poor, like unconscionable working conditions. They bring their children. You know, I'm sorry I ever watched the movie True Cost at times, but 21 cents an hour is what they get paid. And the abuse on girls and women, it's just... insidious. And my question, there is a question at the end of this rant. If you could put a percentage, is a lot more of it cultural in the beliefs about the roles that women play and girls? Is it circumstantial? Like when you're trying to change cultural values, like a religious belief, for example, about the role of women, that's harder. But is there an economic reality? So what's your sense of why is it so insidious against women and girls? I've been living 67 years and I keep thinking, really? Come on.
Well, I feel like culture is too often used as a fig leaf for what are really human rights violations.
Got
so
it.
So when I've met women who are demanding in Afghanistan, the right to go work as a doctor or to go to school or to teach or to be able to drive or to decide how to wear their own hijab without having that forced upon them. And they are met with a gun. To me, that's not a cultural problem. That's a human rights problem. And it is a problem that needs to be addressed by protecting the women's right to participate in the decisions that affect them. So I think it's a temptation, especially maybe, you know, looking at if we're looking at issues outside our own country, to think that they're cultural problems when in fact they are brave women and men and children who are standing up and need support in order to make changes in their lives.
And, you know, I do not want to in any way, shape, or form gloss over what you mentioned that's happening right here in Arizona and the human rights violations. And it's you know, there's lots of us that are involved in trying to change that. But what it comes down to in this situation is inhumane treatment just because. It's not lack of supplies. It's not lack of access to water or blankets. It's just cruelty. And people that are neighbors and live in houses next to us work in those positions, and it's not a mandate, have them freeze, and, you know, I hope it's not a mandate, but it's that basic, they're human beings. It's a human right to have a blanket, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's I want to honor that you said that and just call people's attention to, yes, it's happening right here in the United States. So, and we haven't even gone into the area of, you know, sex trafficking. It's a whole, talk about human rights violation, and that's a whole nother can of worms that I don't know if you want to comment on it or not. It's probably three more shows, but, you know, that's one of the most heinous of human rights violation from where I sit.
I think, you know, we've talked about a lot of terrible things over the course of the last hour, and I think, you know, in my work with Human Rights Watch, for now almost 18 years, I've seen a lot of terrible things that happen to children. But, you know, people say to me, you know, how do you keep doing this work? And to me, the answer is I also see a lot of people making a difference. It's not just that terrible things are happening to children. It's that that things are changing. And I see brave people who make a difference in their own communities. And I see dedicated people working at high levels, including at the level of government, who are actually able to stop human rights problems from happening. And, you know, when I have a picture up in my office that I'm looking at now of a woman who's hoeing a trench with a baby on her back. She's building a school in rural Honduras. But I also have another picture of a woman who is sort of from the side, who was the head of the women's department in the local province of Afghanistan, who had, for having a Women's Day celebration and having teachers read poems, had been threatened. One of the teachers who read a poem had actually been raped and threatened, and this woman's dog had been killed. And she said to me, I am never giving up this work. She said, this is my duty, and as long as I have blood in my body, I will not give up and stop working. I have three daughters and three sons. I'm not afraid of anything. I think when there are people like that fighting so hard for their rights, we have to do everything we can to support them in wherever they are, including in this country, where there's exciting new activism happening and new opportunities for all of us to make a difference.
And as hard as it was for me to prepare for the show, because you have to read about all the bad, people like you inspire me, and I'll remember it. I'll remember the work you're doing. I'll remember that you took a sabbatical and then did some more work in just a different arena. But one of the things that I so admire about the website, and the not just the website, but the work that Human Rights Watch is doing, there are good news sections, and there's really good news to talk to us about hope and possibility and real substantive change. And it's outlined. It's really tough year, some good news for children. And when I read that, you have to focus on that, in my opinion. You cannot just stay on the dark side. I think you have to go to the dark side a lot of times, and more of us should, and then figure out how do we move into the light and be a stand for change. So do you have at your fingertips, or can you remember some of the really positive things? Because I, of course, have the advantage of having the page pulled up on my computer, but there's really good news even in the United States in terms of life without parole for kids. That law being changed.
Exactly. And this is where we'd really love the help of all of your listeners. You're talking about our website, which is, if I can plug it, www.hrw.org for Human Rights Watch. And we have campaigns where we really hope for help from the public. We talked about protecting schools, teachers, and students from attack and armed conflict, and getting countries to agree specifically to make schools off limits. Proofs. We have campaign pages on the website where people can actually write in. And right now we're campaigning for the United Kingdom, the UK, to join the Safe Schools Declaration. We'd love to have your help. We're also campaigning to ensure that jewelry companies do more to ensure that the jewelry that they use is not produced by abusing children. So we've done a lot of research showing that children working in small-scale gold mines are at risk, being everywhere from being crushed by falling rocks to working with mercury with their bare hands and being poisoned by mercury. We have campaign pages on the website where people can write letters to 13 significant jewelry companies around the world, asking them to do more to ensure that the gold that they're using to make, you know, jewelry, a lovely luxury item, isn't produced on the backs of children. So people can really help and get involved.
And it all comes back to educating women and girls. I'm serious, because there are families that allow their children to go to those mines so that they can have food on their table. That's it. I don't judge them. It's like, this is starvation, or my kids going to the mines to work. It's a reality. Or they're going to the, you know, the cow farms to work on the plantation so the three younger kids can eat. So it all comes back to, what are we going to do to change? What intervention is needed? And certainly educating women and girls, to me, is essential to that. And I want to reiterate what you said about everybody can do something. After listening to the show, people can go and like your page on Facebook. They can read about you. They can follow you on Twitter. It's not like they have to do 6 hours of heavy-duty research, soul-searching, and, you know, changing their outlook on life. But that's what I'm a symbol for. That's what the Mrs. Green's World team is working towards, is activating that part of you that wants to be the change. And you can do it. It's within your scope of power and advocacy without an incredible amount of effort. And of course, there are degrees of that. But I love that you said, get involved, make a difference, you know, care for the rights of children. So I am going to ask that question, Zaima. I want to ask that question. How do you do it? How do you know what you know and continue to do what you do without shutting down? I think that a lot of people, they literally shut down. They don't want to hear it. Some of my friends, they say, I don't want to hear any of your gloom and doom or how bad it is. I can't handle it right now. So how do you handle it?
Well, I think, you know, when I talk with someone who's sharing a story with me, whether it's a, you know, a boy in Tanzania who's at a gold mine saying, I don't want to be on this gold mine. I'm here because I failed the primary school leaving exam. And when you fail that exam, there's no chance of going on to secondary school or high school in Tanzania. You know, when I hear the voices of the people share those and trust their stories with me, I feel like I have a responsibility to do something. But what really keeps me going is the knowledge that we can. The fact that child soldiers was you know, widely accepted and practiced 25, 50 years ago in a way that it's not now. I'm seeing in 3 years already 73 countries changing the way they let their militaries interact with schools. We're seeing the numbers of children in the most dangerous forms of child labor go down. We've seen, you know, even to give an example in the United States, where we found children who were too young to buy cigarettes being poisoned by nicotine in the harvest of tobacco. We've seen tobacco growers and the major tobacco buying companies come out and do what the U.S. government has failed to do and actually prohibit children under 16 from working in those farms. So when I see the stories of individuals who tell their story with usually with no expectation that they themselves are going to benefit, translated is something that makes the lives of other children better. That keeps me going every day.
So what a note on which to end. And what keeps me going many, many times are inspirational thought leaders and game changers like you. So thank you for sharing your story and your passion and the solutions and the good news, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And let's everybody be inspired to act. Zaima, I am happy that your life crossed mine, and thanks for all you do. Make it a great, green, intentionally lived week, everyone. The world needs us.